On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the FCC is rolling back everything. Somebody declared war on the Internet of Things, and Gigamon is here to show you the responsible way to be the man in the middle. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 234, recorded April 7, 2017. Gigamon, the responsible man in the middle. This Week in Enterprise Tech is literally brought to you by Sonic, Twit's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. And by Cloudflare, the operating system for the edge of the internet. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare services to load fast, stay secure, and weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's a show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. It's a big old world. And I'm going to need a little help from my friend, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good.
Wait, what is this?
It's an This used to be a Jamba Juice-sized cup, and it was taken down 3 miles underwater.
Yes, that's right. Under pressure. We could be rapping in the Bowie song here. Also, I don't know if you can share it with us, but you had good news about Information Week.
No. InfoWorld.
Oh, InfoWorld. Sorry.
Yes. Apparently, the acquisition by a Chinese publishing company has gone through, and huzzah! Assignments are flowing again. Life is good. So
that means that
I'm hoping to do a VMware NSX article very soon.
Well, you write it and we will come. Now, of course, also joining us is our man representing the other coast of the United States, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it's good to see you. I know your lighting is a little weird right now, but hopefully your wrist is a bit better.
Wrist and hand are fine, and apart from the apparent giant solar flare that is burning out my forehead, things seem to be going pretty well here in the swamp.
Well, gentlemen, solar flare or not, we will do the news, starting with the blips. Now, Android has become Internet OS number one. It's been predicted for a while, and now it's happened. Microsoft Windows is no longer the dominant OS on the Internet. Maybe. Web analytics company StatCounter published their latest internet usage figures and found that 37.93% of all users of the 2.5 million websites that it tracked were using a flavor of Android, while 37.91% were using a flavor of Windows. To be clear, this isn't, once again, the death of the desktop, as Windows still dominates the desktop, especially in the enterprise, but rather the continued explosion of the mobile market and Android's nigh unbreakable hold of the lion's share of users. Rounding out the numbers is iOS with 13.11%, OS X with 5.18%, and desktop Linux with 0.75. It should be noted that the margin of Android over Windows, just 0.02%, is well within the margin of error of the expanded survey based on 15 billion monthly page views. In other words, good job, Android. Now get back to work on your Windows workstation.
They're back. McAfee stands alone once more. On April 4th, a new old name in cybersecurity returned as McAfee's separation from Intel became final. The six-year marriage of the two companies failed to produce the kind of synergy that such acquisitions generally promise, with Intel announcing last September that the split was imminent. Now, McAfee representatives say the company is looking forward to a future more focused than the one possible as part of Intel. How did it happen? Well, McAfee has returned as a private company in a partnership of Intel and private equity firm TPG. When asked about the practical ways in which the new renewed focus would have an impact on McAfee and its customers, Brian Dye, the EVP of Corporate Products at McAfee, listed four areas where McAfee will concentrate its efforts: endpoint, data center, cloud edge, and security operations center.
Oh, sorry, Mommy, for the $1,000 in games I bought online. The FTC and Amazon withdraw appeals. Federal Trade Commission and Amazon Incorporated have agreed to end appeals related to last year's court findings that a company billed consumers for unauthorized in-app charges incurred by children, paving the way for affected customers to seek refunds from the online retailer very shortly. This basically means that Amazon has agreed that enough wasn't done to prevent downloaded games and the like used by children from billing in excess of $70 million to parents' Amazon accounts. If no more snags arise, this means parents will hopefully start seeing refunds for their child's online spending sprees.
There's a new Internet of Things malware making the rounds on the internet, but it isn't one that's trying to create a network-connected bot threat. It's not trying to turn your network-connected camera sensor or homeopathic rose petal-infused scent therapy device into a DDoS bot, but rather it's out to kill IoT. The new strain, dubbed BrickerBot, seeks open telnet ports on Linux's BusyBot-based iOS devices and uses a list of default credentials to log in, reconfigure the kernel, corrupt storage, and brick the device. Specifically, BrickerBot does four things. First, it writes random bits to storage, corrupting the flash. Second, it disables TCP timestamps. Third, it sets the maximum number of kernel threads to one, effectively guaranteeing that not only will you not be able to log back in to fix the problem, but also that the device stops responding altogether. Finally, it reboots the device, completing the brick, or what they're calling the permanent denial of service. An interesting angle to the story is the fact that this malware bears a striking resemblance to an IoT malware strain shared on GitLab that used the same exploit methods to break into IoT devices and update their security. If it is a descendant, perhaps this is the work of an IT worker who was just tired of sloppy Internet of Own Things ruining all our nice stuff.
Google serves up a shot of espresso. Seeking to grab market share from Amazon, Google on Tuesday gave the public a taste of espresso, the software-defined networking architecture it uses to improve performance at the edge of the Google Cloud platform. Espresso optimizes the network path between cloud applications and client endpoints. Instead of using conventional BGP, Espresso dynamically routes data, reconfiguring the transport path based on changing network conditions. Espresso routes 20% of Google's traffic to the internet, according to a post on the Google blog by Google fellow Amin Vadal and his colleagues. Now, Espresso is a follow-up to previous software-defined networking platforms from Google. These include Jupyter, a data center interconnect capable of supporting more than 100,000 servers and 1 petabyte per second of total bandwidth, B4 for data center interconnect, and Andromeda, a network function virtualization, or NFV, stack for Google native applications, containers, and virtual machines.
Finally, in a bipartisan agreement, we may soon see a law closing a loophole in the Fourth Amendment called the border search exception. In what is certainly able to garner praise from just about any U.S. traveler, this bipartisan bill is seeking to require a warrant for the Department of Homeland Security to search the electronics of United States persons. And it's being called the Protected Data at the Border Act, sponsored by Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, Democrat Representative Jared Polis of Colorado, and Republican Representative Blake Fahrenholt of Texas. My bottom line is awesome, dudes.
Our chairman, Ajit Pai, has signaled that the FCC is ready to roll back the 2015 Open Internet Order, or net neutrality, by once again reclassifying ISPs as services and not public utilities. Under Pai's proposal, ISPs would be reclassified with responsibility for oversight of the ISPs shifted back to the FTC. Though the ISPs would no longer be under the jurisdiction of the FCC, Pai would make ISPs sign promises to support net neutrality principles. Proponents of the reclassification claim that the rollback is the only way to remove the uncertainty that is currently hindering investment and innovation in the broadband space. Opponents of the reclassification point out three things. First,
Investment in broadband technologies and spectrum has increased fourfold since the passing of the 2015 Open Internet Order. Secondly, the FTC already failed to regulate ISPs when they were responsible for them pre-2015 Open Internet Order. And third, promises have been extracted from ISPs before with no consequences for breaking those promises. Notably, Comcast promising not to prioritize their own content as a stipulation for their acquisition of NBC, AT&T promising to deploy a rural area in exchange for permission to purchase local telcos, and Verizon, SBC, Bell South, and Quest promising to deploy 45 megabit per second symmetrical broadband to 86 million Americans in exchange for $200 billion. In other words, promises are fine, but most of us would still rather have something with a bit more bite. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're coming to the bites. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you, literally brought to you, by Sonic. Sonic is TWiET's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Now, the internet infrastructure in the United States needs fixing. We all know this. There's too many people paying too much for unsatisfactory cable internet. Sonic tries to fix that. They deliver fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Sonic's mission is to bring internet freedom to all with unlimited and uncapped internet. They deliver residential and business fiber to the premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay. Their internet service plans include 15 email accounts and 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain, and fax services. They even include a home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance calling. Oh, for only $40 a month, $40 a month, Sonic will offer you download speeds of up to 1 gigabit. That's 1,000 megabits per second. Switching from your current carrier is easy, and you can keep your existing phone number. Now, on a personal note, I have always been impressed by Sonic's long stand to support customer privacy. Their record shames other ISPs because they don't treat privacy as an option. It's not a sale value add-on or a tactic to get you to buy their service. Privacy, service, and support is baked into their DNA. By standing up for privacy, for friendly and local customer support, for uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of internet access in America. That's to all Americans. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit and receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Visit sonic.com/twit. That's sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Chiebert, this is a fun one, and I'm going to have to lean on you because I feel that the rant is mighty within you. Because the FCC just brought back territories. Now, this sounds like a feature from Google that they thought of and released and then canceled and brought back. But what exactly is territories?
So the idea is you carve up a map and you say ISP 1 gets this, ISP 2 gets another one, and so forth. It's basically eliminating the possibility of competition in various areas. Now, the weird thing is this particular article, I had to read this thing like 4 or 5 times. Sorry, the author kind of goes back and forth, but it's basically coming down to they're removing a mandate called overbuild. And so the small guys are saying this is great because this means that they're going to be able to go into an area and be able to hopefully get on their feet without having to compete with anyone. The bad news is it removes competition. We would love to have choice. In Honolulu, you know, various areas, depending where you live, you get choice or you don't get choice. Kind of a pain. Ought to be interesting. Anyway, this is supposed to get large vendors like Charter to go and concentrate on areas that are underserved or unserved, according to the article. But come on, it's like we want choice. We all want choice. And choice is one of those nice things that forces ISPs to actually step up and maybe provide better service. We don't know. What do you think, Padre? You know, does this feel like it's removing choice, or is this feeling more like about time we're going to go and cover some areas that haven't had broadband?
Yeah, see, here's the thing. I understand why they're doing this. I do. This is not one of those where I'm just thinking, okay, this is shameless partisan politics. It makes sense that you could entice more companies into the market if you decrease the amount of capital that they have to expend in order to get into the market. And that's what this is trying to do. By removing the overbuild requirement, they're essentially saying, look, you can focus on where you're going to make your money back. And that's fine. That works as long as the companies are truly trying to compete. And what we found is they're not. You look at the major telcos. You look at Comcast. You look at AT&T. You look at Verizon. I mean, actually, Comcast and Verizon is a great example where essentially they fought each other for a while with Verizon trying to roll out fiber. They finally got to a point where Verizon had a conversation with Comcast and said, hey, look, if you give us some spectrum, we'll stop building into the areas that you already control. Essentially, they were ceding an area to one of their competitors. Well, that's what we've got. And that's what overbuild was trying to get rid of. It was saying, look, we will give you the ability to build out this profitable area. But in exchange for that, we need you to build at least X percent in an area that's already served by another telco. And that idea is you do that enough, you have enough companies compete that way, then eventually everyone will have at least two decent selections for broadband provider, which we don't currently have. Curtis, I mean, this does sound business friendly, right? I mean, from an executive viewpoint, it does make sense that you can have more people compete if you say you don't have to spend as much money to start the competition.
Well, yes, you. It is business friendly if you're talking about the business of being an ISP. The question really is whether what we'll see now is more companies jumping into these underserved areas, or this resulting in less competition because you specifically don't have the requirement for overbuilding. And here's the thing that's important. Most areas that are underserved by broadband are underserved because of a business reason. Either the customers are too far apart physically, as in rural areas, or the demographics of the area are wrong to support the high-paying customers that that ISPs want. We're talking inner cities and places that are economically depressed. So in those areas, it's unlikely that you'll see a lot of people jumping in to serve them just because there's this new lack of requirements. I think what we're probably going to see this do is result in more competition in a handful of highly desirable areas and less competition in areas where competition was lacking to begin with. So I think what we're going to see here is a heterodyning of the economics. You know, the best areas will get somewhat better. The less served areas will see even less service.
Yeah. And, you know, T-Bird, it's funny that so this FCC decision, if you look at it, it actually refutes their rollback of net neutrality policies. Because the whole idea of net neutrality policies is they're trying to encourage investment in the system. This is saying, wait a minute. We know that there's parts of the country that you're not going to want to roll out to. You're not going to want to deploy to, as Curtis said, to that rural area with five homes that will never make back the investment that you outlaid in order to get out to them. And so in that sense, yeah, it makes sense not to deploy there, but what net neutrality was saying was that we have to treat these ISPs as common utility bearers. They're no longer service providers. We have to be able to build out to those areas that will otherwise not be served. That was the whole idea of the Rural Access Telephony Clause in the 1934 Telecommunications Act. So in on one hand, you have the FCC saying, well, these companies will deploy to these areas if we let them. And on the other hand, you have the FCC saying, yeah, we know they're not going to deploy to these areas, so we want to encourage them to do it. You can't really have it both ways, can you?
No, I don't think so. In fact, here's a Chiebert prediction. I think one of the next things that's going to happen, especially now that it's no longer considered a utility, or at least that's what they're trying to do, I think we're going to get that ruling that the FCC declared internet services being considered like lifeline telephony. So this administration is so pro-business, it's not even funny. You know, I can rant on that forever, but what this is telling me is that they're going to, the next thing that we're probably going to see, or, you know, a couple down the line, is the end of the government, FCC especially, forcing the ISPs to provide internet connectivity to underserved areas, just like they were forced to provide telephony for the very poorest of the citizenships. So I think this is a really bad thing, especially if you are like me and consider internet to be a need, not a want. You know, especially considering you can't apply to a lot of jobs unless you apply online. So I don't like this trend. I think this is very much taking away a lot of things that should be done. I think, unfortunately, the very poorest of our citizenship is going to really suffer and suffer again and again and again because the Trump administration is super, super pro-business.
Right. And also, before we move on, I will mention that that's already happening. The FCC has already rolled back the lifeline requirements. Internet is no longer considered lifeline available. In fact, the way that they're doing it is kind of strange. They're not coming out and saying we've killed lifeline, but they've said that they will no longer talk to companies who want to offer internet service, like Karma was trying to do this, as a lifeline service. So I think, yeah, we're going to get to the point where, since we are reclassifying, since we're saying that internet access is no longer a utility, therefore it is no longer something that must be rolled out to everyone, that we're just going to have to live with the fact that there are some parts of the country that not only will they never get one of the large telcos running connectivity into their town, their village, their whatever, but also because of restrictive state regulations, they won't be able to run their own municipal network. So this is actually a nice convergence of a bunch of different TWiET topics. We'll have to maybe do an episode on it. Go figure. Let's go ahead and move on. We've got here's a story I think we can all agree on. I think this could be bipartisan. This just makes sense. This is the fact that there's a federally mandated decision coming down that all federal highways will have to have a dig once clause, which essentially means as you redo infrastructure, you have to make sure to put in conduits so that later on we can run fiber without having to incur additional costs. Chebert, this is hard to fight against. This absolutely makes sense. I mean, yes, naturally you're going to want to spend a dollar now to avoid spending $1 million later. But there is one thing that I think a lot of our audience will wonder about, which is, didn't we already do this? Didn't we do this back in 2009 with the big expenditure bill that was supposed to do the dig once clause?
You know, I don't know. This is kind of weirding me out that they're making such a big deal about something that I thought was already in law, but apparently not. You know, they are saying, you know, the idea is an old one. Anna Eshoo, a Democrat from California, is proposing the dig once legislation. And I really don't know of a congressional member that's going to go and introduce a law that's already covered previously unless they're seeing holes in it. I personally would love to see this. Some of the private communities here in Honolulu have done this, putting extra conduits in, and have been reaping the benefits for decades now. And from doing work with the Federal Highways Administration, adding this in really isn't that expensive, especially with the new blown-in conduit systems. You basically drop the pipe in. It actually doesn't even have to be pipe anymore, but you drop it in, and you provide access holes or access closets or whatever every once in a blue moon. And literally, you just use compressed air to blow fiber in. You don't even blow thread in and then pull the fiber. You actually blow the actual fiber in. And these sectionized conduits, you know, in the hole, they have all little sections in there. You have various channels so that providers can actually blow the fiber in. So this could be a really, really good thing. And I think one of our last guests were talking about community networks. I think this would be a really great thing if they can start connecting them. But darn, there seems to be some laws in the way, especially at the state level. So I want to see it. I really do. I think it's about time. I think it's way late. I just hope it actually goes through this time.
Right. And, you know, Curtis, if people are remembering hearing this back in 2009, that's because they did. It actually was proposed when we started doing that massive stimulus package. It never made its way through, and people don't realize it. It never made its way through to being law because there was so much partisan bickering. People just wanted to kill anything that sounded like it was even remotely connected to net neutrality, because even back then that was a big issue. So my question to you is there less political partisanship now? Does this have a better chance of making it through?
I don't think it's appropriate to say that there's less political partisanship. A look at pretty much any of the national newscasts would show that. I think what we're seeing is members of both political parties looking for ways to put their names on infrastructure projects, and this is definitely infrastructure, and very few people really wanting to stand in the way of better connectivity. Another advantage of this is that it doesn't really place any requirements on the private sector. This is something that would be added to government projects, which is what highways tend to be. So you don't have any private industry oxen being gored. Politically, it seems like a win-win. And, you know, standing against it is becoming right up there with standing against motherhood, apple pie, and baseball.
Yes. And who doesn't want to have apple pie while watching baseball? Seriously, that was a question. No, let's move on. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think we've smacked on the FCC and weird law long enough. Next up, we've got a treat for you. Now, you may have heard of this company in passing. We've mentioned them a few times over the years because both Chibert and I have worked with this company through Interop. Gigamon, they are one of the leaders, probably one of the most popular companies in network security that you've never heard of, because what they do is so vital that many companies don't even say that they're using their product. We've got Greg Mayfield of Gigamon. He is the Senior Director of Product Marketing. We'll be coming on to talk a little bit about the black box magic, actually I should say orange box magic, that they do. But first, let's take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, you know Cloudflare. Everyone knows Cloudflare. They were the ones who mitigated a 400 gigabit per second DDoS attack before anybody realized that that was actually possible. They're the ones who can manage over 1 terabit per second of data capacity. They're the ones on a mission to build a better, safer, more reliable internet so that you can stop worrying about downtime, slow load times, or ultra-complex management. Cloudflare has a global network of more than 100 data centers that caches your content and moves it closer to your visitors. Now, they've automatically enabled the latest internet protocols like IPv6, HTTPS rewrites, and HTTP2 to keep you secure. They speed up every request to your site with performant DNS caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. And even with all of that, you can be up and serving in less than 5 minutes. This means that you can make your site, your app, your API more secure in less time than it takes for you to go down to the corner for a cup of coffee. Now, I know that they've earned their rep by mitigating DDoS attacks, but that's just a tip of the protection that Cloudflare offers. Their web application firewall, or WAF, is powered by a massive IP reputation feature that analyzes the attacks being reported by all their customers to proactively protect all their other customers. This doesn't just protect their clients, but the rest of the internet. It's the OS for the edge. Their security team is constantly watching for fresh 0 days and deploying firewall rules to block exploits before they get to you. Now, with this kind of protection, you might expect to get a massive bill every time you get hit, but Cloudflare offers flat pricing for everyone. That means that if you are attacked by a DDoS or a surge, you pay the same amount. Plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprise, which means that no matter what plan you sign up for with Cloudflare, you're joining a massive neighborhood watch for the edge of the internet. Here's what we'd like you to do. We'd like you to give Cloudflare a try. Cloudflare is offering Twit listeners a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions. Just visit cloudflare.com/twit. That's cloudflare.com/twit. to sign up today. Again, that's cloudflare.com/twit. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Joining us today on my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest who can drop knowledge on the Twyatt Right, is Mr. Greg Mayfield of Gigamon. Greg, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, I did hype you up a little bit just because I've always been impressed with Gigamon. Your people were one of the very first that I worked with when I started working with the Interop project. And, well, what is it exactly that Gigamon does?
Gigamon provides visibility solutions that enable better security. So our solutions basically span everything from physical networks to virtual networks to public cloud environments, private cloud, hybrid cloud environments, and so forth. So the premise that we basically focus on, excuse me, is that with access and visibility to the data, you can then manage, secure, and understand it as best as possible throughout the infrastructure. So we fundamentally deliver data in whatever formats needed to the appropriate tools at the appropriate time at the appropriate speed.
Right, right. Now, for those who are maybe parsing through what that means, you know, the most simple way to think of Gigamon is a tap. But that doesn't even come close to doing justice what Gigamon does. I mean, when you're talking about visibility, you're talking about true visibility. This isn't just an appliance that you drop into your network and it starts giving you a copy of all the packets that are running through your network. You have a couple of very interesting bits of technology that give you visibility into parts of networking that many of us didn't think was possible. Can you talk at all about that, or am I getting into that gray area?
No, certainly. The thing is, we provide the ability to really slice and dice and access the network data to the nth degree in a very granular process. So it's not like looking at everything coming down a pipe and just saying, okay, we'll forward it here or there like a switcher or a router. We can actually really dig into and, based on policies, take certain chunks of data based upon packet information or session information and then deliver that to the appropriate tools. They could be customer experience tools. They could be monitoring and analytics tools. They could be firewalls and intrusion prevention tools for more analytics and processing. So we can take it, once again, at a packet level or a session level and feed that information to those tools. And we can feed a part of the packet. We can feed just a chunk of the session. We can actually mass packets. So if there's some type of compliance regulation that's involved, the IT team won't necessarily see all of that information going across the wire. So we have quite a lot of control when it comes down to identifying and managing and delivering that traffic to the tools across your network environment. And we're quite agnostic. I mean, there's no proprietary protocols that we offer. We work with the majority of vendors out there in the marketplace, from firewall vendors to IPS vendors to security analytics solutions and so forth. We basically make them more effective and enable them to do their jobs better.
Right. And let's talk about one piece in particular, because this is one of the areas in which I think Gigamon is absolutely an industry leader. Anyone can tap. Anyone can mirror report. Anyone can record the data stream. But one of the things that Gigamon got into very early is this idea of being able to give you visibility into things like SSL streams, into encrypted streams. You can do both in-band and out-of-band, in-line decryption of SSL communications in real time, which is important if you're at an enterprise, in a network that needs to look for malware, that needs to look for malicious connections inside of encrypted streams. How does that work?
Well, it's not a new approach by any means. So just to elaborate on your point, Father, we were talking about out-of-band decryption we've been doing for the past several years. So that's basically taking information and feeding it to a passive device, so decrypted information. So we're sending it to a SIM or to, say, a network analytics or forensics type of tool. What we've introduced more recently is the ability to do that inline. So we can actually be in the data path and feed information to other inline tools that can then block it or process it appropriately, like a firewall or an IPS solution. And in fact, though, it can be a negative term, but we're using it in obviously a trusted manner, is man in the middle. And we have a diagram on there that you may want to share with the audience. But specifically, we can intercept the SSL communication, which initiates from the client. And then through our capabilities, we can then feed that decrypted information to out-of-band tools. As I mentioned before, we've been doing that for quite some time. That could be a network analytics tool, for example, network forensics tool, And we can also simultaneously feed it to multiple inline tools like firewalls, for example, or proxies or whatever it may be, and then send that back to the initial server that was targeted in an encrypted form. So we decrypt and then we re-encrypt. In a sense, we're acting as a man in the middle here because we have to obtain and import the specific certs and keys that are used in that communications process, but we're a sanctioned or trusted man in the middle in order to do that full inspection.
I'm glad you brought that up because our audience never disappoints. And as soon as you described how it works, Java 28115 in the chat room said, wait a minute, this is a man in the middle. And yes, it is a man in the middle, but as you mentioned, it's a trusted man in the middle.
Yeah.
Let's break that open a little bit because I know there's some people in our audience who they get very, very worried whenever we start talking about man in the middle attacks. Mm-hmm. What are the ramifications of doing this in an enterprise? I own the network. I'm managing my network.
Yep.
Is it right for me to be running a man-in-the-middle attack against my employees, my customers, my clients?
Well, clarify. Let's say it's a man-in-the-middle design.
Yes.
It's not an attack we're not doing it for nefarious reasons. But the thing is, every organization and every industry vertical is going to have different policies for what they need to see and can't see. So, for example, financial services is going to have different mandates than healthcare or government agencies. So you need to have the ability to selectively decrypt and choose what's appropriate to decrypt and let other things go through that aren't necessarily appropriate and would violate some type of compliance mandate. So selective decryption is really important when you consider should you or should you not and how should you deploy SSL decryption across a network environment.
Right. We've got Keith 512 in the chat room who he's repeating something that all of the Twit listeners, the entire Twit army has learned over the years from our security guru, Steve Gibson, which is TNO, trust no one. And that's been their mantra.
Yeah.
But I mean, okay. And I'm going to get non-PC here. The rules are different when you're operating on someone else's network, right? I mean, if I'm running a financial securities network, I don't just want to know the traffic that's going in and out. I need to know. It's my responsibility to make sure that nothing's being exfiltrated that could harm my clients.
Exactly. You're liable for that information. So having the knowledge of – break it in two areas. First, having knowledge of the traffic itself and controlling that is one aspect. Then put the security perspective on in saying if this is encrypted traffic, is it something that's suspicious or malicious where we have to block it or, quite frankly, decrypt it and analyze it in more detail? And once again – it's not an all-or-none approach. It's based upon selective decryption that's right for the organization and right for the industry itself. And in fact, I have another slide just to maybe share with you. This is very simplistic, but with this diagram, we're basically showing that there are really two approaches. Say on the left-hand side, if someone's using a file-sharing site, I'm showing Dropbox, but obviously there are many other sites out there, that through the policies you set up through a tool – And we're using categorization based on URLs and domain names. You can basically state that this is going to a file sharing site. We're going to send it to our analysis engine. In this case, we use WebRoot. We embed that in our solution set. And we'll feed it to an inline tool for further inspection analysis before sending it out to the Dropbox site. However, if you would go to a site that's maybe a little more compliance laden, and contains information like personal banking or personal healthcare information, like you see in the slide, obviously that would violate, decrypting that information would violate some type of compliance mandate. We would let that bypass and maintain its encrypted state. So with this capability, I mean, we have the ability to whitelist and blacklist, create whitelist and blacklist categories for policy enforcement. That term is used sometimes for proxies, for firewalling. We're applying it in the same manner to SSL decryption. And this really simplifies the process for how you set up your policies versus using what I would say very rudimentary things, you know, IP source and address information, ports, VLAN ID, and so forth. You could certainly use those types of parameters, but having this ability to simplify and set up those policies based on more familiar types of categories certainly simplifies and makes the lives of SecOps teams a lot easier.
Right. And this is a light touch, intelligent approach to man in the middle. In other words, just as you described, there are some sites that are much higher risk than others. If someone is pushing out to an FTP site, you bet I'm going to decrypt everything and make sure that nothing is leaving my network that shouldn't. Same thing with a Dropbox. But if I'm running into HIPAA regulations, okay, yeah, I don't touch that. And I need an appliance. I need policies that are smart enough so that I don't accidentally turn on the defaults and suddenly I'm violating law.
Yeah,
tell
exactly.
Tell me a little bit about, because you've got the you've got a decryption tool that that Chibert showed it to me, and I was actually quite impressed. The SSL, the GigaSmart Traffic Appliance. Can you tell me a little bit about that? How does that work?
Well, we provide a combination of hardware and software that you can deploy multiple places in your infrastructure. Whether it's, I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, you know, a physical world or in your excuse me, your virtual world, or in a cloud, public cloud environment. So with that dedicated, you know, purpose-built hardware and software, one of the capabilities we offer is this intelligent traffic control and management. And within that, SSL decryption is one of the key features. So the thing is, it's basically a software license that's enabled within our visibility nodes. And customers can, you know, through purchasing a license, provide that ability to look at and decrypt and inspect traffic inbound and outbound, inline and out of band appropriately. We've been doing out of band for quite some time in customer demand and market demand, and was just pushing us specifically to do it inline, which is very important because, as you mentioned, you know, you certainly want to inspect certain suspicious types of sites or transactions like FTP file transfer. You realize that while malware certainly takes advantage of inbound activity and sneaks into a network over SSL, there's actually more danger when it sneaks out of an enterprise environment through hidden command and control. That's actually growing faster and more rapidly than just the inbound type of malware that's out there. It's the malware that's sneaking out, which is more dangerous, where they steal proprietary information.
Now, with the GigaSmart appliance, we do have a question from, again, from Java78115. Wants to know, what's the maximum number of connections? And I think he's looking at what kind of enterprise can he put this into? How high can it scale?
We're still going in. We're in beta testings right now as we speak. We will officially ship in about a month. And the thing is, right now, because it's a combination of hardware and software, GigaSmart is basically our solutions that are feature set that is comprised of those software capabilities, like I mentioned, slicing and masking and so forth. And then there's also a dedicated hardware module that provides the compute power necessary to handle very compute, you know, and processing intensive applications like SSL decryption and re-encryption. So with a GigaSmart module, we can support about a gig to a gig and a half of processing SSL throughput, specifically SSL traffic. And with our appliance, we can actually support multiple modules. So basically, you can grow your performance literally by adding more and more GigaSmart modules to it to handle whatever needs are appropriate for your enterprise or your service provider.
Right. You just determine which areas of the network need to have taps and which network, what parts of your network need to be decrypted, and that's how many modules you drop in.
Yeah, it's a centralized approach. Consider this kind of like a data orchestration appliance, where within that appliance, you can feed multiple segments. And then within those segments, you can also have multiple types of devices that you feed decrypted traffic to. So it's not one device per segment, for example, or one segment per appliance. You can actually use this as a very powerful aggregation point and data control point across your entire infrastructure for SSL decryption.
Right. Now, let's just say that this is a high-end enterprise product, and I know that the list price of a single module is going to go for about $30,000, which actually is far less than what it used to be even 5 years ago. Yeah. And I know also, doesn't Gigamon provide perpetual licensing? Like you buy it once and you can always use it?
Yeah, we provide perpetual licensing. So, for example, I mentioned the GigaSmart software and its hardware. Obviously, the hardware is part of the appliance that does that compute processing for heavy loads. The licensing that we sell for GigaSmart is perpetual. It includes the webroot capabilities I mentioned earlier. It's not a subscription-based type of model. Basically, you just buy it and you deploy it within your appliance appropriately. And for those folks that have – those customers that have already purchased the out-of-band decryption capability we've had for the past several years – they can easily just provide we'll provide an upgrade for them so they can deploy that and then enable both inbound and outbound simultaneously going forward.
I was wondering about that. I was wondering if you already had gigataps or gigaswitches in your rack, would this make it obsolete? So you will update my older equipment.
Oh, sir. And clarify this thing. You said taps and switches. I mean, taps tend to be passive devices. You can have active, but the thing is, those are used obviously for tap and aggregation points. That's where we started as an organization. But over the past several years, we were providing more of these intelligent, you called it a switch. You could say it's a visibility node, or packet broker is another term that's used, but that's where the intelligence is. And through those switches, no matter where they're deployed, that's where we're providing that, through those packet brokers or through those types of visibility nodes, that's where we're providing the intelligence that I talked about earlier.
Okay. Oh, if we had an audience member who was listening and saying, this could be something I can use, what do they already have to have in place? In other words, in order for them to actually get benefit of having a Gigamon box inside of their network, what has to already exist for them to get more than just that warm, fuzzy feeling of having the orange box?
The thing is, there's no true dependencies. Obviously, our value is that we can identify, manage, and control that data. And the data obviously needs to be shared by multiple devices. So you could say that we follow or support the tools in the environment. And those could be customer experience tools or analytics tools or security tools outright. So put us near those tools, so we can actually feed them and connect them appropriately. And this is whether you're deploying SSL decryption or not. SSL decryption inline, once again, is new for us. So the capability to feed these other devices and provide the appropriate bandwidth and not do mismatches and not provide contention for span ports, that's what we've been doing for quite some time. And that means we need to be near those tools that are actually in your existing network environment. That's one of the benefits. We don't require you to rip and replace anything in your network infrastructure or your security infrastructure. Keep what you have and insert us as a middle layer in between, say, your routers and your switches and so forth. We'll provide that extra layer of intelligence and data control to feed to all the other devices in your network environment.
Right. I want to go ahead and bring in my co-host here because I can see them in my little preview monitor and they are bustling with energy for this.
Not those guys.
Yeah, no, those guys. They're good. They're good people. Aside from the fact that Curtis does look like he has a supernova going on his head at the moment. Curtis, you had some security questions about how this all works.
Yeah, one of them. We've gone over in detail the fact that this is structured like a man in the middle. And so my first question is whether your products have an effect on detection of illegitimate man-in-the-middle attacks. Does it complicate the overall security picture from that point of view?
I would say it complicates it. I mean, whatever the data is or whatever the traffic flow is, we will take and identify that and feed it to another tool. So if you have some type of, we could certainly address and understand a DDoS attack, but there are other tools that are going to log it and manage it appropriately. So maybe I would say that if you're utilizing your tools appropriately and the way, and we feed those tools with necessary information, there shouldn't be any problems. Obviously, if you misconfigure something, we're going to feed as much data to that tool. If it's misconfigured, it may be overloaded or something like that, which is, I think, just standard networking best practices activities to avoid. Curtis, hopefully that answers your question. I want to sure I certainly understand your perspective.
No, it does answer the question. But I want to use that to lead into another question where you're talking about working with other appliances, other systems.
Yeah.
I think everyone understands that in today's security infrastructure, you're going to need multiple layers, multiple pieces. So with those integrations, with passing the data, do you need to have APIs that Gigamon supplies in order to do the integrations with other equipment? Does Gigamon do all of that integration, or is it happening at a layer of data passing where you don't really need to use APIs at all to get the integration done?
Quite frankly, Curtis, it's more towards the latter point where you don't necessarily need APIs. We're using standard protocols and so forth to pass that information back and forth and share it between tools. However, I mean, there's really three layers. Think about our infrastructure and our platform is really comprised of three layers. Certainly, you have the dedicated hardware and software. Those are the visibility nodes. Then we have the traffic intelligence. That's our bread and butter. That's the heart of what we offer, where we can slice and dice the data and do things like SSL decryption and metadata generation and so forth. Then on top of it, you actually have the orchestration, kind of the management plane. At that management plane, where we can control and set up and set up policies across your infrastructure, whether it's physical or virtual or cloud, that's where we would have APIs. And so we have RESTful APIs and using other types of capabilities to link into infrastructures that run, for example, AWS for public clouds. We support and link into VMware environments and OpenStack environments using APIs. That's more at the orchestration and management level for that purpose. Other things tend to be just standard networking protocols that we take advantage of.
I should mention that AWS is a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. let me throw over to Chibert really quickly. Chibert, we've got Waterfall Mount in the chat room, who is bringing up a very good point, something that I know a lot of our audience will be thinking, which is, can I do this already? I mean, can I just set up a dedicated Linux box that breaks certificates so that I could look at all the traffic running through my network? What makes Gigamon's approach different?
Well, it's the intelligence that's on top of it. I mean, you can, let's make a point of distinction between just monitoring traffic and truly accessing and controlling and understanding the traffic to a very granular level, which is what we can do. And the thing is, obviously, the management aspect is really important. You may be able to set up some device to look at a small chunk of data or look at all of the data running across a wire, but doing it in mass and doing it in a very consistent and simple way is really the benefit there, is that we provide that consistency and that common platform, the common management platform that allows you to do that across your entire infrastructure as opposed to segment by segment or device by device.
Chibert, where do you see the use of these devices? I mean, they're definitely a higher end. They're not as ridiculously expensive as they used to be. I remember, didn't we have an interop story of a Gigamon box being stolen off the back of a FedEx truck that was worth like $250,000.
Actually, it wasn't a FedEx truck, so apologies to FedEx. Denny Mew, one of the founders of Gigamon, got out of a taxi cab in New York in front of the Javits Center, and the taxi cab took off before Denny could get the Gigamon switch out of the back of the taxi. So they started tracking. It eventually ended up on eBay, and I think Denny bought it back from the person so that it wasn't out in the wild. Now, I should say, I was the schmuck that called one of the other founders, Tom Gallatin. He was actually enjoying a baseball game in Florida, spring practice. And I go, Tom, you know, I've been under non-disclosure for a couple of years on this thing you've been telling me about and asking me questions and so forth. Are you guys ready to come out from behind the curtain? And he goes, kind of. And what the other founder, Denny Mew, he calls him up. And Denny actually shows up at Hot Stage back when we were in Belmont with a Gigamon, orange Gigamon switch that didn't even have serial numbers on it yet. And this all got kicked off because we were out of light for the interop show. Now, to get to your question, the reality is there's a lot of people that need this kind of thing. Healthcare needs it, definitely finance, military. But if I remember right, one of the biggest customer bases for Gigamon, or at least has been in the past, are actually carriers. Being able to go and, you know, if you're a carrier and you're trying to provide five nines of reliability, you need to go and look and see what's happening to your network. And being able to get these taps in, being able to go and put instrumentation in, being able to encrypt and decrypt. You know, sure, I could do this with SQUID and Etacap and things like that. But to be able to do it at line speed is going to require me to run a fairly hefty machine with lots and lots of processing horsepower. And I'm pretty sure that's what the Gigamon appliance does in silicon. Greg, is that correct? You guys basically are putting in silicon, some dedicated silicon, heavy duty processing power. So I'd have to do like maybe a 2 or 3 die quad core or 6 core Xeon server just to be able to keep up in the same kind of throughput?
Yeah, certainly. It's dedicated hardware with the intelligence of the software running on top of it. You know, for some folks that think about it from the SDN or software defined world, there are certainly some control and allocations you can do in that world for looking at data. But when it comes to looking at and decrypting data and re-encrypting it, it's off-the-shelf hardware isn't going to cut it. You won't have the speeds or the performance that you need. In some cases, you won't even have the I/O capability to support all the other tools that need access to that decrypted data.
Greg, let me ask you this, because yes, it would be nice to get this kind of actionable intelligence out of my network, but if I'm running an enterprise network, I already have monitoring tools. I already have taps. Mm-hmm. I already have intelligence in places where I think it will help me the most. What in your mind would be the thing that changes about my requirements that would require me to go up to something like a GigaSmart?
I think here's one example. There's many. I mean, obviously there's data port contention where you have span port contention where people don't have enough ports on their precious networking tools to feed security devices. Or they may find out that they have a mismatch between the number of span ports or ports that can receive and send information. So you have that gap right there. And you can certainly apply a tap there in some cases, but if you want to have more intelligence on how you're going to control that, that changes things where you need to move up to something like one of our visibility nodes. But another capability is think about companies that do SIMs, where they're now charging on the amount and the volume of alerts. There's a lot of alerts or there's a lot of information that you could send to the SIM across the network. You know, logs can only take you so far. They're very reactive. You have to have some more intelligence behind them. If you're charged on all of those, that can actually be quite expensive for enterprises. We're actually implementing metadata where we could generate metadata or the data of the data, if you will, and send that to some of these SIM vendors out there. Splunk is one of the vendors, Plixer is another vendor, where they can take a subset of information and still react to it and monitor it and log it appropriately. It's a very different approach, but it saves companies money. And once again, it's only sending the appropriate traffic to the appropriate tool as opposed to sending a lot of duplicates or irrelevant traffic to some of these security tools, in this case, SIMs that are out there.
Greg, I want to thank you for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. You know, it's nice to get representatives from companies who I've had a long history with, and Gigamon's definitely one of those. In fact, I still have my super neon orange Gigamon shirt with the big G, and everyone always thinks that it's for the San Francisco Giants, but it's just slightly the wrong shade. If you could, please let our audience know where they can find you, where they can find Gigamon, and where they can read up more about the different solutions that you might be offering for their network.
We have just a simple site, www.gigamon.com. And within there, you could find access to the various solutions and the products that we provide for physical network environments, for cloud environments, and so forth. You see what we have as a quick excerpt of that on your screen. I mentioned data in motion earlier. You know, that's basically saying that's the granular data that's of interest to you that's traversing your network. Data in motion may differ from one country to one company to another. So AWS is one of the key fortes we offer, visibility into AWS, which we announced last year. So I'd say go to gigamon.com first, and then by any means, if you have any questions, we'll be glad to take them from there. Unfortunately, I don't have a Twitter account, so I'm not quite up with the Joneses on using modern social technology.
That's Greg Mayfield. He is the Senior Director of Product Marketing at Gigamon. Greg, thank you very much for being with us on this Twitter.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 SSL connections. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, of course, to Greg for being our guest, but also to my co-hosts, without whom I would not want to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. Chibert, we got to start with you. What have you been up to other than crushing styrofoam cups in the depths of the ocean, and where can people find your work?
My Twitter address is at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And enjoy my Twitter conversations with the Twilight Riot. I'm going to do one last thing. GeoMeek had a really fast question about, about. So I use the GigaTaps and the GigaSwitch. So instead of having to upgrade to a 10 gig diagnostic tool, I actually slice out, say, web traffic, send that to my 1 gig tool, and that way I can still use my existing tools and leverage them further. So it makes my tools dramatically more efficient. So kind of cool stuff because I'm a big Gigamon believer.
That's Brian Chi, is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, and is our geek in paradise. Also, we need to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin, who from here forth shall be known as One Punch Man. Curtis, can you tell people where they can find your work?
Well, you can find what I'm doing these days at lightreading.com. I'm also publishing at Enterprise Cloud News, one of our new sites. And I'm about 2 weeks away from being able to reveal some exciting news about what I'm doing next. So stay tuned and keep following me on Twitter at KG4GWA for all the latest on what I'm doing, when, where, and occasionally even why.
Curtis Gebert, thanks again, and we will see you on another episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Of course, thanks to you as well, to the person who's watching, to the person who is listening. It's because of you that we get to do this 1 hour of enterprise goodness each and every single week. I want to make it easier for you to get all of your Twiat Riot goodness by going to our show page. Just drop by twit.tv/Twiat. There you will find not just of all of our back episodes, as well as notes and links to the stories that we cover, but also, very importantly, a little drop-down menu where you can subscribe to the RSS feed. That will mean that you will automatically get the version of your choice, audio, video, or high-definition video, into your device of choice, downloaded each and every single week. It's one of the best ways to make sure that you stay current and the best way to support This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo, who have continued to let us do This Week in Enterprise Tech, to our engineers, Alex and Kara, and to my TD, the technical director, Kevin. Kevin, again, this is that time of the show where we offer you some redemption. First, could you please tell the people at home what it is that you do here at Twit TV?
I try to make s'mores like Anthony does, but I end up messing up and have to wipe away all the melted chocolate off the walls. And then Kara laughs at me.
Yes, indeed. That's Kevin, folks. We don't know what's wrong with him, and there's not a name for it. But we always offer him redemption. We give him a question about some knowledge he should have picked up from the show. And Kevin, my question is this. When you consider the OSI model and where fiber will be existing as we go from network to network, how much is the Gigamon GigaSmart module?
A half-life.
Oh, I'm sorry. The answer was $30,000. I thought you would have remembered that. I made this one really, really easy, Kevin, but maybe we will get you next week. Until then, I am Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiring.